Well, good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, and welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm your host, Jim Lafferty. All alone here today is my co-host, Maria Hall, is working out of town this week. But happily, my guest, Steve, hopefully will be with us in just a few minutes. What we're going to be doing, of course, is what we do every couple of weeks with Steve Rohde as our guest, is review the goings-on in what is a very, very active U.S. legal system. Steve Rohde is the author of two books, numerous articles and book reviews on constitutional law and history. He's the former president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and a special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Steve Rohde is also the host of a new podcast called Speaking Freely, which is produced by Miz Studios and is available on Spotify and iHeartRadio and other streaming platforms. I should mention that Steve Rohde is also, along with Maria Hall and myself, a co-host of the National Public Affairs Show, Law and Disorder. And that show, my friends, is now airing on close to 200 radio markets in the nation. If you want to learn more about that National Public Affairs Show, you just go to lawanddisorder.org, lawanddisorder.org. The archives of all of our recent shows are there. And you'll find out what our schedule is as well. I should take this minute or so, by the way, to remind everyone that we're in our winter fund drive right now. And it's very important that you support this station. You know, we only have a handful of paid members of the station. Everybody else, myself, Maria, all of our guests, of course, are unpaid. We don't get money from the government. We take very few, the only kind of, we don't really take corporate advertising. We might take advertising from the Symphony or from the Red Cross or something, but not from commercial corporations. So what we bring to you is unfiltered. Call us at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. Well, I understand we now have Steve. Hey, Steve, how are you? I'm sorry about the confusion. There was just some confusion at the station.
No, I totally understand. Let's remember that the FCC is under the control of the Trump administration.
Well, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if there's been some hijinks because it generally goes so smoothly. Well, it's good to have you, my friend, and I've already done your introduction, so let me get right into the cases. There were a couple of important rulings in cases involving Donald Trump this week, one that had been brought against him and two others, having to do with the Trump DOJ bringing charges against James Comey and Letitia James. Tell us about these two cases and why you think they're significant, Steve.
Well, thank you, Jim. You know, in this period, our side's going to have to be at the top of its game. We're going to have to enforce the rule of law while the Trump regime is suffering from its abysmal incompetence. Unfortunately, last week, a judge in Georgia dismissed the last pending criminal prosecution against President Trump. He has now avoided three criminal cases that have dissolved right before our eyes. This one was regrettable because it was a state prosecution in Georgia, which was insulated from the shocking decision last year of the Supreme Court granting and inventing absolute criminal immunity from federal charges for Trump. Here was a solid criminal case that should have gone forward. Unfortunately, a specially appointed state prosecutor, Pete Scandalakis, filed a motion from the state side to dismiss the case. He asserted that it's not illegal to question or challenge election results. He filed a 22-page motion. He's a career prosecutor who has been first a Democrat and now a Republican. The federal inquiry, he concluded, was a better route to take. The case should have gone through the federal court, but we already know that Jack Smith, the special counsel appointed by the Justice Department under Biden, had voluntarily dismissed that case because of the absolute immunity decision. So yeah. It was of no help for the state prosecutor to suggest the case should be heard in federal court. Unfortunately, he found errors in the prosecution by Fannie Willis, the star-crossed prosecutor who was accused of having an affair with another prosecutor. Why that would release the case was never clear to me. Unfortunately, this special prosecutor found that he wouldn't be able to prosecute Trump until he left office, and that could be another 5 or 10 years, and that the citizens of Georgia would be ill-served. I don't know why they'd be ill-served whenever the law could be used. Finally, he argued that it's taken 2.5 years for this case to be heard, but of course that's no excuse if it's a strong and powerful prosecution. He said that the famous phone call in which Trump asked the Secretary of Georgia, Secretary of State, to find him 11,000 votes, it could either be found to be innocent or a guilty phone call. Well, that's a factual question that should have been heard by a jury. So yes. This is extremely disappointing and a real setback for the move to hold Trump accountable.
Indeed, indeed. And what about the cases regarding James Comey and Letitia James?
Yes, now that's the good side of the coin, because the incompetent Trump DOJ, by appointing Letitia James, who was an insurance lawyer and a former Trump attorney, she was appointed to handle the cases against James Comey and Letitia James. Well, an independent court, and I mean by that they went outside of the jurisdiction because the other judges were recused, found that Letitia James was illegally appointed as an interim attorney general. U.S. District Judge Cameron Curry issued an extensive opinion that both prosecutions were void because Letitia James could not lawfully indict those individuals, and she herself was illegally appointed by Trump. Judge Curry said all actions flowing from Ms. Halligan's defective appointment, including securing and signing Mr. Comey's indictment, as well as Ms. James, were unlawful exercises of executive power and are hereby set aside. This was significant because they could have taken Lindsey Halligan to the Senate for a confirmation, but they had no confidence she would be confirmed. There are possibilities of refiling the charges, but with the case of Comey, they waited so long that the statute of limitations has run, and they may not be able to reindict James Comey. It's an open question about Letitia James. So right. This is where the incompetence of this administration may actually be helping the pursuit of justice.
Indeed, indeed. Well, I'll talk about a case right here in L.A., if you will, but it has broader implications, I'm sure. It's a civil case that a judge ordered can move forward. I'm thinking, of course, of the case of the journalist Maya Lau. Her lawsuit against L.A. County for retaliating against her for simply reporting on police misconduct. Tell us about this case and where you think it might be headed.
This was a high point of the week in having this journalist's civil lawsuit go forward against L.A. County. In a 10-page order, Judge Sherrilyn Peace Garnett of the U.S. District Court in Los Angeles denied L.A. County's attempt to dismiss the First Amendment lawsuit. They found that Ms. Law has plausibly alleged that the county violated her rights. She found that a reasonable jury could find that by referring Law for criminal prosecution, the L.A. County's Sheriff's Department's conduct had the objective effect of chilling speech. The judge said it should be common sense that journalism is not a crime. You know, we are in a period when fundamental principles like that have to be announced by a judge. Journalism isn't a crime, but few courts have had the chance to make clear that a retaliatory investigation of a journalist violates the Constitution. Lau was an award-winning journalist, formerly with the Los Angeles Times. She sued the county and the sheriff last May when she discovered that the sheriff's department spent 3 years criminally investigating her after she published an investigation uncovering a list of hundreds of sheriff's deputies with histories of misconduct, including sexual assault, fabricating evidence, and using excessive force. Many of your listeners may remember that series of LA Times articles. She was represented by the civil rights law firm of Lovey and Lovey, as well as the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. The order advances the case against the county into the discovery stage, where they can take depositions and other discovery devices. I am hopeful that by allowing this case to proceed, it will expose the county and the sheriff's department for a pattern and practice, which we're also seeing in the streets, of targeting journalists. And therefore, I think it's a serious blow in favor of the First Amendment.
Indeed, indeed. Well, moving from L.A. up to the U.S. Supreme Court, last week the U.S. Supreme Court paused Trump's effort to fire the head of the U.S. Copyright Office. Talk to us about the background of that case, how the court ruled, and, well, what it means going forward.
Well, here's a slight glimmer of hope at the U.S. Supreme Court, which has been so dutifully staying injunctions against the Trump administration, more than 17 of those so far this year. Trump, in order to enforce the unitary executive theory, this Reagan-era doctrine that Trump sits at the top of the entire federal government and that Congress cannot create agencies and insulate them from partisan influence, Trump has been removing officers from all sorts of federal departments. And in many cases, when the lower courts have enjoined those removals, the Supreme Court on its shadow docket has turned those rulings on their head and allowed Trump to go ahead and fire these people. Now, in this case, the director of the U.S. Copyright Office was fired by Trump. It's believed because Trump disapproved of her advice on artificial intelligence. But in any event, he had no right to fire her. And she is one who advises Congress on copyright issues. So this would invade the separation of powers between Congress on the one hand and the executive on the other. It's a glimmer of hope that the injunction keeping her in her job has not been stayed by the court. There was a predictable dissent by Justice Clarence Thomas. He would have permitted Trump to go forward to fire her. But a majority of the court decided for one time not to do Trump's bidding. We are going to see this year on the merits how these cases play out and whether this dangerous unitary executive theory is going to take sway and give Trump powers that no president has previously exercised.
Yes, yes. Well, last Wednesday, two National Guard members were shot while on duty in Washington, D.C. And of course, one has since passed away. The other is in terrible condition. The Trump administration's use of National Guard in Democratic-led American cities and Washington, D.C. Has been fraught with controversy from the start, and some courts have found it unlawful. What is the current status of the law in this regard?
Well, this is another bright light coming from a U.S. District Judge, Gia M. Cobb, in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, right there in the heart of where the National Guard has been dispatched. This case was ruled on and heard before those shootings and has nothing directly to do with the shootings. It has to do with the illegality, frankly, of exposing those National Guards on the streets of Washington, D.C. This judge found that Trump administration exceeded the bounds of their authority under a particular Title 49 of the D.C. Code by using D.C. National Guard for non-military crime deterrence reasons through mechanisms like patrols in public spaces. The judge found that the Department of Defense lacked the statutory authority to bring in National Guard members from outside the state. And we now know, tragically, the two who were shot and one who has died were from West Virginia.
Yes.
While granting the preliminary relief, the court issued an administrative stay of 21 days to allow time for appeal. But it's what's important is the underlying legal analysis. The District of Columbia Attorney General, Brian Schwab, called the decision a victory for D.C., home rule, and American democracy. The suit had been brought on September 4th. The complaint alleged that the use of National Guards affects D.C.'s sovereignty and right to self-governance, even though that's extremely limited, and inflames tensions. An executive order from Trump had declared a crime emergency in D.C. back on August 11, and a second order deployed National Guards on August 25th. Roughly 2,200 members of the National Guard are currently in D.C. We know that these deployments have taken place throughout the country in Tennessee, Oregon, and Illinois. They are under other court challenges. But this was such a thoughtful opinion. I hope it'll be upheld in the appellate court as well as the Supreme Court if it can come to its senses. And, of course, the Trump White House calls Trump's order lawful to deploy National Guard and describe the lawsuit as undermining the president's highly successful operations to stop violent crime. Well, it's hardly been that. And finally, and now these court rulings are pushing back against his unlawful deployment of National Guard.
Well, in just a couple of minutes, we're going to have a station ID. And I mentioned that because I want to take just a minute or so before that to remind you that we are in our winter fund drive here at KPFK, and that means that we're looking to you, part of the KPFK family, the listeners, the reason we exist, the reason we do what we do, the reason our employees work here as opposed to other places where they could frankly make more money, the reason why myself and the dozens and dozens of other broadcasters on this station don't receive pay and don't expect to receive any pay. It's because we're simply dedicated to bringing you a form of journalism, unfiltered through corporate contributions, unfiltered by government money being received. But no, just you as our contributors keep this station on the air. And we have rent costs and electricity costs and phone costs just like you do. And so we're asking you at this time to please give us a call at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK, if you will. A donation as small as $25 makes you a fully paid-up member of this station, if you will. We are hoping that we get many more contributions of that level, but also contributions of $100. And there's, if you go to our website, there's all sorts of ways in which we thank you when you make those contributions. Sweatshirts and T-shirts and coffee cups and films and musical recordings of some of your favorite entertainers. They're all available to you for contributions of $50, $60, $100, and up. Those of you that are working and making good money might want to contribute for those who can't. Those who can't or are listening, don't turn it off. We're happy to have you. We're sorry you're in a situation where you can't afford to contribute, but we love you just as much and we want you just as much as our listeners. But we'd urge those who are doing well to perhaps fill the gap and not only contribute for themselves, but throw in a little something extra for those who are listening and can't afford it right now to support the station. Well, 818-985-5735. We are going to take our station ID now, so you can make that phone call now and not miss any of the programming. We'll be back with you rather quickly, though, so stay tuned, my friends.
This is the moment where KPFK is needed most, because mainstream media's coverage is not balanced and reliable. It's expensive for KPFK to continue our fair and equal coverage, which includes broadcasting the voices of people on the ground and those speaking truth to power. If you value reliable, unfiltered news coverage, support your independent radio station today by calling 818-985-5735. Hit option 2. Any amount helps. Pledge online at kpfk.org.
And we are back with you even quicker than I thought. We had a very short station ID break. You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild Show, my friends. I'm still Jim Lafferty. I'm missing my co-host this week because she's off working in Washington, D.C., in fact. But we're glad you're listening with us. And we're doing what we do every couple of weeks on the Lawyers Guild Show. We have on our constitutional expert, Stephen Rohde, to talk to us about what's been going on in the courts, because goodness knows there's a lot that's been going on in the courts having to do with the runaway undemocratic Trump administration and all sorts of related items of legal jurisprudence. So, and continuing on that same subject now, Steve, let's take a look at another lawful versus unlawful orders case. And I'm thinking of the case where six members of Congress and the Senate have received bomb threats after posting a video on social media reminding members of the military, which is absolutely true, that they have a right to refuse Trump's illegal orders. In fact, they have a duty to refuse Trump's illegal orders or any other commander's illegal orders. Tell us about the legal aspects of this ongoing controversy.
Thank you, Jim. And if you'll indulge me, and I'm sure you will, to add on to your pledge break, I've supported KPFK for decades. I recently made a contribution and got a premium, which was I.F. Stone's book, The Trial of Socrates. I.F. Stone, an extraordinary muckraker and journalist that many of your listeners know, and I got this wonderful book, which I'm reading. So I love KPFK, and I'm privileged to have been able to do these programs with you, because I don't think you're going to hear an hour examining these legal issues in depth the way that you, Maria, and I have been able to do every few weeks. So I'm grateful to KPFK, and I hope your listeners are too.
Well, thank you for that, Steve.
Well, on this case, this is just one more example of the consequences of truth-telling in the Trump fascist era. By now, I think all listeners will know that a few weeks ago, six six elected officials, Representative Maggie Goodlander, Chrissy Houlihan, Jason Crow, Chris DeLuzio, and Senators Alyssa Slotkin and Mark Kelly, issued a very incisive video claiming that the White House is pitting our uniformed military and intelligence community professionals against American citizens and encouraging members to refuse illegal orders. And they said the truth, which is that military officers and enlisted men have the duty and right to refuse illegal orders. But Trump immediately labeled those videos seditious behavior, punishable by death. He shared another user's post calling for the congresspeople to be hanged. This is the kind of inflammatory rhetoric that comes out of the White House. Unfortunately, U.S. Congressman Chris DeLuzio of Philadelphia specifically reported bomb threats. I know that Mark Kelly has reported an upswing in threats to his office. But they are fighting back. Kelly issued a statement. My wife, Gabby Giffords, who we all may remember, nearly lost her life in an act of political violence. Words have consequences, especially when they come from the President of the United States. What Trump said this morning, that my colleagues and I should be put to death, is dangerous. We can disagree fiercely and say what we think without resorting to stoking violence. Unfortunately, we've seen that at every turn, Donald Trump looks for opportunities to divide us. Now, that's a very important statement, and I think listeners here or elsewhere that have any of these representatives or even just contacting Senators Slotkin and Kelly should send them messages of support. If they're receiving bomb threats and attacks, they should also know there's a wide array of Americans who believe that their truth-telling was right and protected by the First Amendment, and that these kinds of threats have no place in a democracy. And I'm glad that we'll turn now to the merits of what they talked about.
Yes. Well, and by the way, it should be noted, of course, it's just come out, I think, today, maybe it was yesterday, that Secretary of Defense Hegseth, who's been one of those clamoring for punishment of these members of Congress, himself was videotaped at a forum in Michigan some years back when he was a Fox reporter saying the same damn thing, saying that you have an obligation and a right, of course, to refuse illegal orders in the military. So talk about talk about the usual, I guess, in this administration. But Hegseth himself has said the exact same things that Trump is calling for the execution of Congress members for saying. My goodness. Let's continue on. Continuing on, in fact, that subject, the U.S. has escalated its deadly military attacks against boats coming from Venezuela in the Caribbean, claiming they're trafficking drugs. Critics accuse the White House, of course, of committing war crimes. What laws and policies are at play here? And if the U.S. Is violating the law, is there anyone who can be held accountable?
Well, this is exactly why those members of Congress and the Senate were so right to warn soldiers and military officials of their duty to deny and refuse illegal orders, because what the Trump administration and Hegseth are doing is illegal under international law, and we're going to discuss that right now. There have been, and this number keeps escalating, more than 80 people in 21 strikes on boats in the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific have been killed by strikes in international waters. And the latest outrage is that when in the Caribbean, some men survived the initial blast on their boat and were in the waters, the U.S. military had a second strike to kill those men who posed no threat to the United States as they were barely swimming in the ocean. And there's a serious question now that Hague says orders authorize that, a further general enforced them. And that both of those strikes, the initial strike and all of these 71 strikes on those boats are illegal. This, what is shocking and what has come out in the press is this has been done with the in direct violation of military attorneys who have given advice against these strikes. Now, this is a developing story. Much of the information is coming out anonymously. There will be one Senate hearing tomorrow, and there'll be further Senate hearings. But the Washington Post and others have covered the fact that lawyers within the Department of Defense specifically warned that there was no right of, quote, self-defense for boats, even if they were carrying drugs in the Caribbean Ocean or in the Pacific. There is no right then to use lethal force to kill people on those boats. They are not an organized armed group seeking to kill Americans. There's no actual threat justifying self-defense. And there is no free-floating right of the United States or any country to go about the world killing people on the allegation that they are engaged in illegal drug smuggling. What the reports have revealed is that the Trump administration, going back months now, under the leadership of Stephen Miller, tried to get the CIA to sign on to a plan of this kind through covert actions. And CIA lawyers questioned that and questioned that the country was not in a armed conflict and could not justify the use of such CIA operatives. Hmm. So then Stephen Miller and the Trump administration turned directly to the U.S. military to engage in these strikes. Now that is fully public, and we've seen the consequences of that. Many of the lawyers and other career officials at the White House National Security Council and the Pentagon and the Justice Department had, over the preceding months, questioned and raised concerns about using lethal force against narco-traffickers, and many of those who've now left the government or been reassigned. So in protest over what was happening, many of those lawyers left, and they, unfortunately, that decision to leave, to decide do you stay in the government when your government is doing illegal things, or do you leave that government, is a very serious moral and ethical choice. By the summer, the NSC's entire full-time legal staff of about a half a dozen lawyers were gone. And former Pentagon General Counsel Paul Ney was let go in May, and he had been among the lawyers who had raised concerns about the legality of these lethal strikes. So the absence of these seasoned national security lawyers serving in a role had been a retardant, had been a drag on these illegal activities, and instead they apparently found pliable, willing lawyers to authorize these strikes. I think this is a story of momentous impact. It comes on the heel of Hegseth blurting out official war plans on Iran earlier this year. He is an incompetent individual, serving only because he is a spokesperson for Trump. But when you see Republicans and Democrats calling for investigations, and now finally today, the family of one of the victims, of one of the sailors, has filed an action, a complaint, in the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. And we're going to hear much more about that because new forums are being opened up to hold these individuals accountable. Of course, where they should be held accountable is right here in the United States.
Indeed, indeed. And I'm still thinking about the fact that even the CIA, famous for its black ops operations, understood the illegality of this. Well, all right, moving along. Ted Cruz has been spearheading efforts to criminalize nonprofits and other NGOs. Why? Well, he claims that when they're funding protests that are critical of the government, like the No Kings protest, they ought to be prosecuted. Tell us about this proposed new law that he's pushing. How much support does it have? And what about the First Amendment?
Well, Ted Cruz, I think, went to Yale and may have skipped the class on constitutional law.
Really?
The Stop Funders Act is what he introduced a few months ago. That the funders part stands for financial underwriting of nefarious demonstrations and extreme riots. This bill would add to our RICO statute. Now, we have the racketeering statute that has been used against the mafia and criminal enterprises. That when there's a predicate crime and a group that is conspiring to violate that crime, then the very broad RICO provisions can be used against such an organization. They have added rioting to the list of predicate crimes in the RICO statute. Then they want to skip from that designation to then calling demonstrations riots, and then they can trigger investigations of all of the organizers of these events. And they, of course, exaggerate the circumstances of these events to call them violent. Fortunately, group's analysis, there is a group called the Crowd Counting Consortium that estimates the number and the nature of these rallies. Based on an earlier rally, they found that 99.5% of the reported protests had no injuries or property damage whatsoever. And in fact, in 10 documented events that did involve some violence or property damage, it was actually committed by people against the protesters, not by the protesters themselves, but by counter-protesters, as well as some believed provocateurs in these crowds. One demonstration in St. Louis, in Salt Lake City, an armed safety monitor shot and killed a peaceful demonstrator and wounded another. Now, the facts, of course, always get lost so that Ted Cruz can cause hysteria to support this kind of legislation. They exaggerate, and he has a co-sponsor, Senator John Cornyn of Texas, who will just say words without any factual basis. He said radical left-wing groups who fund acts of violence, coordinate attacks against law enforcement, and spearhead the destruction of property must be stopped. Cruz called the protesters radicals, Marxists, and jihadists, and they've asked that the DOJ use these tools to investigate. Now, the power of investigation, one time the Supreme Court in the McCarthy period said the power of investigations is the power of repression. Because they've targeted George Soros and the Open Society Foundation. If this statute were to pass, the Ted Cruz amendment, it would widen, although the DOJ is already looking into some nonprofits. So this is a bill to be opposed, the Stop Funders Act. We should all be contacting our legislators in the Senate and in the House if it gets there, because the criminalizing of peaceful protest goes to the heart of how a fascist regime enforces its will. And that's exactly what's happening here.
Exactly. Oh, dear. All right. Well, let's turn now to a little bit different than what we sometimes do, but I'd like to turn now to a couple of recent articles that you've written, because I think they're very applicable to what we're talking about. Let's start, for example, with your review of a new ACLU report that exposes flaws in the capital punishment that appeared in Ms. Magazine, I believe. Tell us about the report and your assessment of it in your article.
Yes, I was pleased Ms. Magazine published this piece because I wanted to give the ACLU of Southern California's report. Well, this was a national report, I should say. There's a separate report from the local ACLU called Restoring the Death Penalty Fatal Flaws, Innocence, Race, and Wrongful Convictions. Yeah. What I started to read was that on the first day of his second term, Donald Trump issued an executive order entitled Restoring the Death Penalty and Protecting Public Safety. Now, this was against the background, and many of your listeners will remember this, that in the waning days of the Trump first term, he presided over the execution of 12 men and one woman within 6 months. This is the federal death penalty, the most consecutive civilian executions by the federal government or any state in the then 244-year history of the United States. It was an unprecedented killing spree that ended a 17-year bipartisan federal moratorium. What's important about the report, frankly, many of us have known now for decades how seriously flawed capital punishment is. But this was an opportunity to gather up that evidence as many states are reconsidering the use of the death penalty. Fortunately, 23 states have ended the use of the death penalty by law or practice, but there are still 27 states in the federal government who use it. Yeah. Since 1973, at least 200 innocent people have been exonerated from death row. Fortunately, they were exonerated in time to save their lives. Because this same report indicates that through research, we know of at least 21 people who very likely were innocent and were wrongfully executed. And in all of this, there is racial bias, The death penalty is used out of all proportion against innocent black people. A report from the National Registry of Exoneration said that black people are over seven times more likely to be wrongly convicted of serious crimes than white people. You know, when you read statistics like that and you hear Chief Justice John Roberts brazenly claim that we have a colorblind society and that we don't need laws like the Voting Rights Act, when you see the perpetuation of racism in this very serious form of punishment, you know what kind of a country we live in. I urge everybody to go either to Ms. Magazine for my article or the national website for the report itself. Spread it among your colleagues. We have to keep up opposition and ensure that this barbaric form of punishment is once and for all abolished.
Yes, indeed. And finally, you wrote an open letter to the president of Northwestern University, your alma mater. You wrote it to express your concerns about academic freedom. What was going on there that inspired you to write the letter, and what's the latest with respect to what's going on there?
Well, President Beenan of my alma mater did not listen to my letter. The day after Thanksgiving, he signed an ignominious agreement with the Trump administration, settling claims of discrimination. He paid, he has agreed to pay $75 million of Northwestern's money to the Trump administration. In exchange for certain research grants to be resumed, which should never have been lifted in the first place. President Beenan crowed that Northwestern runs Northwestern, and he denied the agreement invaded into the province of the university. Well, I studied the agreement, and sadly, that's not true. We don't have time to cover all of the provisions in how Northwestern has capitulated to the Trump administration. But for your listeners, one is very important. Back in April of 2024, the then president of Northwestern signed an agreement with the Northwestern Divestment Coalition. It's called the Deering Meadow Agreement. And it provided a range of benefits to recognize Palestinian faculty and students. All of these provisions have been swept away now by this shameful settlement. They were going to provide the cost of attendance of five Palestinian undergraduates to attend Northwestern. They were going to create temporary physical space and renovate a house for Middle East and North African and Muslim students. They were going to investigate both anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim and Palestinian incidents. They were condemning the doxing of protesters and advising employers not to rescind job offers for students who engaged in speech protected by the First Amendment. And they said that they would examine and look into the questions of Islamophobia as well as anti-Semitism. All those provisions have been swept aside. The one-sided settlement only speaks of looking into anti-Semitism, not Islamophobia. It gives up a lot of the university's control to the federal government. I'm writing a piece on this, and I'll let you know when it's published. I'm deeply ashamed of my university for joining some of the universities that have capitulated. They should have stood strong with Harvard, which actually went to court and won an injunction issued by a federal judge on September 7th. So Northwestern had a blueprint if they wanted to resist what Trump was doing, a judge, U.S. District Judge Allison Burroughs, and we've talked about her case on this show, said that we must fight anti-Semitism, but we equally need to protect our rights, including our right to free speech, and neither goal should be sacrificed. So that's the importance of that, Jim.
All right. Well, that does wrap it up for us today. Steve Rohde, thank you once again for your diligent work and for joining us as a guest here on the Lawyers Guild Show. Maria Hall will be back with us again next week. Until that time, I, Jim Lafferty, thank you on behalf of her and myself for listening to the Lawyers Guild Show today. Before we go off the air, we urge you to give a call to 818-985-5735 and make your pledge during our winter pledge, and your support for this station, a station which continues to bring you the